We have with us, once again, live in the studios, Jav Parrish and Rhea Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover this week. And starting out with the release of some more videotape on the John T. Williams shooting.
Yeah, the SPD, in response to an order, released the videotape shot from the vehicle of the officer who shot John T. Williams a few months back. And you don't see a whole lot on the video because the video doesn't show the actual shooting. It shows Williams crossing the street with a knife and a piece of wood, and then a few seconds later, the officer with his gun drawn crossing the range of the camera after him. And then really all you do is you hear what happened. And it's fairly, we're going to play that audio for you, for people who haven't heard it, because it really underscores what happened. And so if you don't want to hear the sound of somebody being shot, you might want to turn off the radio for a couple seconds. But this was the audio from the officer's patrol car.
Hey! Put the knife down! Put the knife down! Put the knife down!
Now, how possible would it be for anybody to actually put the knife down in the amount of time that lapsed between when those commands were given, the three orders, put the knife down, and when he put it down? It was very, very, very quick, and also did not possibly give time for the original story of SPD, which was that Williams lunged toward the officer. He couldn't possibly have been lunging toward the officer, or the officer wouldn't have been saying, put the knife down. He would have been saying something else. But it was what, about 4 seconds?
Yeah, it was actually from the first time he tells him to put the knife down to when the shot is fired is 4.74 seconds, according to my calculation.
Which is not the 6 seconds that you keep seeing reported in the news, which is, again, appallingly short amount of time for an officer to issue a command and then just shoot someone when witnesses said Williams wasn't even facing the officer at the time, and it was clear to them, just witnessing the event, that Williams wasn't even aware anyone was talking to him.
Yeah, and there's actually been two different theories put out, and you don't have to actually believe either one. They don't, they're mutually contradictory. But one is that Williams didn't hear him. The other is that Williams was in the process of closing the knife and putting it down, which is why the knife was closed when the knife was found. And that again would suggest he was complying with the order, but just not nearly in time to avoid being shot.
So, all right. So moving.
So there will be an inquest in January for that. The inquest jury will see and hear that video, of course, but it will be very, very interesting to see what the outcome of that trial is.
Okay, moving on from that to other SPD related news with Shandy Cobain.
This week, Officer Shandy Cobain, who was the Seattle police officer who was caught using a racial slur against a Latino suspect on videotape while the suspect was lying on the ground, that officer was acquitted of any charges by King County Attorney Dan Satterberg. He said that the racial slur was not a hate crime, and then Police Chief John Diaz referred the case to City Attorney Pete Holmes to see if the what was caught on videotape could be considered a misdemeanor crime of assault in the fourth degree. Now, Attorney Pete Holmes issued a statement letting Cobain off the hook, and he explains in great detail why the incident was not physical assault. And then at the very end, he makes kind of a disturbing one-sentence statement about how the racial slur was bad, but, you know, it wasn't a crime either. I just want to read that one-sentence statement. It says, quote, "While I abhor the use of such language and remain committed to the city's race and social justice initiative, Cobain's comment was not unlawful under the state's hate crime law, as prosecuting attorney Satterberg determined, and does not violate any city law." But he doesn't really explain why, even though he spent, you know, several paragraphs explaining why it's not physical assault. Well, no duh, it's not physical assault. Chief Diaz knew it wasn't physical assault, and nobody was saying that it was physical assault. Everybody was saying, look, you know, it's the language he used. It's the attitude he took towards someone who was never even charged in a crime.
And it was the context of that being done by a person, you know, with the power to detain somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, so I found it kind of disturbing that Holmes, sure, he made a ruling on what Diaz asked him to, but he didn't really address the questions that the public had in this case. Is this a hate crime? And he just basically passed the buck and didn't do his job, in my opinion.
All right. Moving on from there to report out this week about the Pacific Place Garage.
Yeah, the Seattle Times had an interesting article this week about how the Pacific Place Garage is losing $500,000 a year because fewer people are parking there and fewer people are shopping at the high-end stores downtown. Why should we care about this? Well, because the city bought the Pacific Place Garage, and they paid much more than market rates for it because the difference between what they paid for it and what the market rate was an outright gift to Pine Street Development, the developer who was building Pacific Place Garage. It was talked about at the time in 1997 as a great example of what a public-private partnership could do in sparking development in the downtown retail core. And at the time, many people, myself included, protested this, saying that the city should not be in the business of giving gifts to private developers in order to get a parking garage and a shopping mall downtown. And lo and behold, because the city paid $73 million for a garage that cost only $50 million to build, the difference being the $23 million gift to Pine Street Development, and the city still owes $63 billion in bonds on
million.
That garage. Or million.
Million,
I'm sorry. $63 million in bonds on that garage, and has to make payments of $5 million this year. The city's scrambling to come up with a way to do that. I think it's pretty clear that these public-private partnerships are a losing deal in the long run for taxpayers.
Yeah. Not that the Seattle Times article actually pointed any of that out.
Well, actually, yeah, that was in the Times article, but you had to read the entire thing. You had to read to the end to find out a lot of that information.
Yeah, you had to find out the information, but you didn't find out the context, so that it was, you know, all of the promises that were made during the initial.
You had to live through that to remember that this was a widely hailed by the Downtown Business Association, the city council that was very, you know, pretty much run by the Downtown Business Association, as a great example of what a public-private partnership could do. And yes, this is what taxpayer money should be used for. It should be given as gifts to developers, and the city will make out big on this because they'll get all this tax revenue, blah, blah, blah. And here we are 12, 13 years later with a money-losing public garage, and the city's can't sell it because real estate prices are low right now, and they're hiring a consultant to try to figure out what to do.
All right. Well, from garage money problems to state budget money problems.
Yeah. The next time that you see somebody down and out or disadvantaged or whatnot, kick them in the teeth or shout slurs at them or something. And if you do get prosecuted for it, unlike Mr. Cobain, you can simply say that you're replicating the state budget, mm-hmm. because that's basically what it does.
Oh,
it
and in the meantime, you should kick some children and elderly people.
Well, I was getting to that.
Especially if they're state employees.
Yeah. The state budget basically kicks the poor, the sick and the young. $4.6 billion that Christine Gregoire was charged with bridging the gap between what the state was bringing in and what it was taking out. And of course, the biggest issue is that Gregoire and the state legislature have completely taken off the table any prospect of bridging that gap by raising any money. They're entirely doing it by cutting instead. So the word eliminate used some 80 times in Gregoire's budget. That includes $1.5 billion going from K-12 education, including the suspension of the voter-approved initiatives that that mandated spending on K through 12. It eliminates the basic health program, eliminates Disability Lifeline program, which we talked about last week.
And remember, Disability Lifeline is for people who are disabled, can't get a job, and are not getting any federal disability funds.
Yeah.
They really are living only on their state disability, so cutting the money to them is going to put them on the street.
And similar to that, the state food stamp program, which gives food stamps to people who are ineligible for various reasons for the federal program, that's being eliminated as well. So is the children's health care program. You can just go right on down the list. It is primarily being balanced on the backs of the people who can afford it the least because of the reluctance of state politicians to charge the people who could actually afford to spend more on it. That is the people who, under our state's extremely regressive tax structure, are taxed the least in this state, the people who are making over $200,000 a year.
And the businesses that get enormous amounts of money in B&O tax breaks. We're talking about Microsoft and the high-tech industry. We're talking about the biotech industry. We're talking about Boeing, which is not even a Washington corporation anymore. They're based in Chicago, and yet they still get state tax exemptions. These are the kind of things that could easily be done to fill the budget gap and to ensure funding for the people who need it the most, for whom, you know, state spending should really be allocated. But those are the folks who are going to get cut off, elderly, the sick, the poor, the disabled, and kids.
And the particularly galling thing about all of this, I mean, aside from all the suffering this is going to inflict, is the hypocrisy of hearing Gregoire and her various allies, both Democrat and Republican, talking about not considering revenue increases by honoring the will of the voters, when at the very same time they're suspending the will of the voters in terms of spending on K-12 education, because that's not as important as not raising taxes. It's really honoring the will of people who you're afraid might vote you out of office.
Yeah, and I don't recall voting on any initiative or anything that had to do with closing tax loopholes for big businesses in the state of Washington. That wasn't on the ballot.
Yeah, maybe we should.
Maybe that should be.
Consider that for next time.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, but you're assuming that then they'll honor the will of the people.
Right.
So. Gotcha on that loophole. All right. Anything else on that, on the state budget?
No, let's. It's got to be good news in here somewhere. Let's keep going.
Okay. Well, then we're moving on to national, which should have lots of good news.
Uh-huh.
Starting with the economy and our wrap up of.
I wrote an article last week, and it's on the Eat the State website. It's the top 10 economic stories of 2010, and I'm just going to go through a few of them here on the air, so that folks who don't have internet access can hear about what I think are the top 10 economic stories of the year. Number one is the global nature of the economic collapse. The Federal Reserve, it turns out, functioned as a central bank for the entire world in 2008 and 2009. In my mind, that's the story of the decade, not just the story of the year. The fact that major banks in Europe and all over the world, and that the central banks of nations from the Far East through Europe to Latin America came to the Federal Reserve and took out low or no interest loans, because the global financial system that those of us who were protesting the WTO back in the late 90s said that the global financial system could be a risk to us all. It turns out it really was a risk to the entire world, and the U.S. Federal Reserve bailed out the entire world. That's a major story, and nothing about that has changed.
And there's very much a risk that could happen all over again.
Oh, yeah. Number two on my list is the Fed's current policy of quantitative easing is an under-the-table bailout for U.S. corporations. The fact that the Fed is doing its best to keep interest rates near zero is allowing a number of U.S. corporations, particularly those who are poor, who have poor credit, to refinance a record amount of junk bonds that were set to come due in 2012, 2013, and 2014. About a total of $700 billion in corporate debt is being refinanced. Some of those companies are taking out bonds that have 50-year or 100-year terms. Come on. A lot of companies don't last 10 years, much less 50 years or 100 years. They're not going to be around to honor those debts. Number three on my list is the IMF rising from the dead just in time to impose austerity measures on smaller nations in Europe, from Greece to Ireland, and to and on countries that are lining up to impose austerity measures even before there's a crisis, like Belgium and Italy and other nations in Europe. So
that's rising from the dead like a zombie.
Yeah, everybody. Yeah.
Not a pleasant rising.
A flesh-eating kind of rising from the
dead. Christmas story kind of thing, but something dark and disturbing.
Yes, number four on my list is just the enormous size of the financial industry in this country. In the mid-90s, it accounted for about 17% of the gross domestic product of the U.S., and now the financial industry is well over 60% of our gross domestic product. And the Dodd-Frank bill is doing nothing to trim the size of big banks, big insurance companies, you name it. And of course, also responsible for the growth of the financial industry is the massive subsidies that it's gotten in the form of the 15% capital gains and dividend tax rate. You can read more about that on the internet. I've written about that in the past. Number five on my list is more banks failing in 2010 than in 2009. This is after the FDIC assured us at the end of 2009 that the crisis had reached the turning point, and 2010 there would be fewer bank failures. Well, in 2009 the total was 140. In 2010, as of November, it was above 150 and counting. Two more banks failed this week. It's now about 154 total for 2010. Seems to me the crisis is still going strong. Number six on my list is the biggest banks are still misbehaving, from refusing to modify mortgage loans to robo-signers and filing defective paperwork with bankruptcy courts, to sending a huge posse of lobbyists to Washington, D.C. in order to gut the provisions of the Dodd-Frank bill and to keep regulators from imposing the strong regulation specified by Dodd-Frank. The biggest banks are not changing their modus operandi one bit. Number seven on my list is low interest loans plus misbehaving banks equals a new perfect storm on the horizon. As Jav just said, things have not changed, and we could be headed for another collapse fairly soon. Number eight is flash crashes are the wave of the future in the stock markets. I wrote an article about that a week or two ago. You can read more about that. If you don't know what a flash crash is, you might want to get familiar with the term.
Hint, it's not the same thing as a flash mob.
Yeah. And number nine on my list is microcredit banks, which were hailed as the savior of poor people worldwide, giving them low interest loans through nonprofits. Microcredit banks became privatized in the last 10 years and started behaving as badly as the biggest world banks, and are heading for a major collapse because they made risky loans. They hooked poor people, extremely poor people, on high levels of debt at high, extremely high, even usurious interest rates, and those people will never be able to pay those loans.
Yeah, sort of a combination of the payday loan industry and an artificial bubble.
Yeah, exactly. And number 10 on my list is, guess what? It's the end of 2010, and nobody has been prosecuted for the mortgage meltdown, the financial collapse, the banking crisis, you name it. And it looks like nobody will.
Well, that's because there was nothing wrong. We're still doing all those behaviors.
Yes.
We are.
That exactly
is why we're at risk of more financial mayhem, and why it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. I hate to say it, and it's certainly not in the holiday spirit. But it's looking grim right now.
And one reason why they're changing all the locks on the gated communities. So,
and should keep doing so regularly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, from that happy news.
Yeah.
Let's move on to what the our elected officials in Washington, D.C. did this week.
Oh, no, they did not commit mass suicide. That would have been the happy news. But, particularly in the Senate, there's a lot of end-of-year lame duck session jockeying going on, and a lot of it is pretty ugly. You know the old saw about sausage making in politics. Well, this is particularly repugnant sausage making, and consider us all vegans at this point. We had, in particular, There's a number of different bills that the Senate is trying to get through the lame duck session before additional Republicans are ushered into the Senate and the Republicans take control of the House during the session in the beginning of January, the new congressional session. Senate Democrats are trying to pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They're trying to pass the New START treaty. They're trying to pass an omnibus appropriation bill, because individual appropriation bills have been stonewalled by the Republicans, and in fact, over the past several months, Republicans have been stonewalling almost anything that they would perceive as handing any kind of a victory to Obama and the Democrats. This is why you have this end-of-year pileup. This is the first time, actually, in modern history that not even the defense appropriations bill has been passed by Congress before the end of the session. And so you have, at this point, at the end of this week, heading into Christmas week, the spectacle of the omnibus appropriations bill. That's the bill that is necessary to be passed by the end of the year in order to keep government functioning, has actually been pulled from the Senate calendar because of procedural hijinks by the Republicans insisting on the entire 60 billion page bill being read out loud by parliamentarians in order to try to stall everything else from being considered. So that's been pulled from the calendar. That's not even scheduled to be considered by the Senate right now. You have the spectacle of the START treaty, which actually does apparently have Republican votes to pass right now, but it also may not get a vote, and it may not pass because you have Senate Republicans threatening to not pass it because they're objecting to the scheduling of the DREAM Act, which is the children of illegal immigrants, and essentially citizenship bill for students and children. You have the appropriations bill, being objected to by Republicans because they're objecting to earmarks when in fact many of those earmarks are coming from the very same Republicans that are, objecting to it to begin with, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. You have the food safety bill, which we talked about a few weeks ago as having passed the Senate and having already passed the House. Well, it turns out that it had to go through again because there's a constitutional requirement that any bill with spending attached to it originate in the House, and that bill would originate in the Senate. Well, the House went through and repassed it again with the identical language, and the exact same bill that the Senate passed by a 73-25 margin two weeks ago. Now you've got Republicans refusing to pass it just because they can, basically. You've got Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which nobody on earth thinks at this point shouldn't be repealed except for a few Stone Age Republicans, and they're using every parliamentary trick in the world, including denying funding to troops in the field right now in order to try and avoid gays openly serving in the military. It's not a question of gays serving in the military because, bad news, they already
just
do.
It's the question of talking about it.
Yeah, it's a question of whether they're asked to lie about it or not.
Yeah, and of course the Republicans are against talking about most things.
Yeah, well, except for, we had the incoming House chair of the House Banking Committee talking last week about how the government is not there to regulate the banks, it's there to serve the banks. So they're willing to talk about bending over backwards for the wealthy. They're simply not willing to talk about, helping out ordinary people. And the spectacle in particular with the nuclear treaty of tying the safety of not just the United States and the national security of the United States and protecting us from nuclear proliferation and weapons that could literally end all life on Earth, but also the safety of the entire world. You're talking about making that secondary in priority to procedural hijinks in the Senate. It's just, these are children that are running our country. It really, really is appalling.
Mm-hmm. That's a real low blow to children there.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I really shouldn't have said that.
Children
because children have common sense, and children by and large are not hypocrites.
Let's put it this way, these are spoiled 2-year-olds running.
Well, except spoiled, dishonest 2-year-olds.
Yes.
At least 2-year-olds are honest.
We can spend the rest of the show just narrowing it down exactly.
Yeah,
what we're dealing with here.
So it was very much a depressing week for seeing how things work in Washington, D.C., or how they don't work, as the case may be.
All right. Well, moving on, research study out this week?
Yeah, good news, strong evidence that United States voters that paid attention to, the more people paid attention to media outlets, the more they were well-informed during the 2010 midterm elections. This from a new study put out by the World Opinion, World Public Opinion firm. However, that by and large, U.S. voters were substantially misinformed on many of the key issues of the campaign. That coming because a lot of people don't pay attention to news sources, but there was also one significant assumption that people who watch regularly or daily Fox News turned out to be even more misinformed on issues than people who watch no media at all. This is similar to several studies that have been done in the past about the effect of Fox News, but it just really reinforces that it's kind of a chicken and egg question. Does watching Fox News make you stupid, or does your being stupid make you watch Fox News? It's really kind of hard to tell.
All right. Moving on, stem cells.
Yeah, this is the genuinely good news, and maybe we can end with this for the week, because we gotta have something uplifting. You can see cultural conservatives' head exploding all over the country when this happened. Stem cells apparently used to cure a German man of AIDS this past week. It's the first time that anything has been found to not simply control the spread of the AIDS virus, but actually eradicate it.
That
and
is
it was
good
done
news.
Through the use of stem cells. Stem cells whose medical research is still banned by law in the United States because people are afraid of ending the lives of stillborn embryos. Instead, you have them saving the lives of grown people. It really does underscore once again how anti-science this country has become and how we're being left in the Middle Ages by other countries around the world.
All right. Well, we still have a couple minutes left, so I'm sorry we can't end on that note. Italy and Greece.
Okay, let's spend this positively also. Austerity measures in Europe that Maria was referencing in the top 10 list, resulting in very widespread protests in Greece and especially Italy this past week. People occupying airport runways, people occupying railway stations, this in countries where they actually have and use railways for passenger travel. Widespread arrests and injuries in protests in Rome, this over a no-confidence vote for Silvio Berlusconi, the prime minister in Italy, who narrowly survived that after both austerity measures and a series of sex scandals. This is a man, mind you, who controls much of the media in Italy, so people getting their information there and paying attention to what's going on, even though state-controlled media controls much of the official information that's being put out in that country. So it really does raise the question of why we aren't more up in arms about the class warfare that's being waged on 98% of this country in this country, and why we can't do more about that.
All right. How about some events?
Yeah, today is Immigrant Rights Day. Speaking of the DREAM Act and possible citizenship for people, there is a several public events actually going on today, the most notable of which between 2 and 3:30 o'clock. 3:30 this afternoon, Washington New Sanctuary Movement is hosting a procession that will go in Kent to the regional jail. It begins at 2 o'clock at the corner of 4th and GOWE, in front of Mexico Lindo Restaurant in downtown Kent. So if you're down in South County, go and check that out. And just as a reminder, next week, Mind Over Matters, it'll be Saturday morning, so Marie and I are dedicated, but frankly, we're not that dedicated, so
it will be Christmas morning. We will be in our jammies opening presents.
And, yeah, we'll be with our families. So for everybody, have a wonderful holiday season. We'll be back on New Year's Day because we are that dedicated. Uh-huh. In 2 weeks, we'll be talking about the overhyped and underreported stories of 2010, as well as the stuff that happens over the next couple weeks. So have a great holiday season. Check out Eat the State at www.eatthestate.org, and thanks to all of you for listening and supporting Mind Over Matters in 2010.
Yeah, but no worries, I'll be here.
Yes, yes, course. You will definitely be here.
We'll have our normal uplifting content for you.
Send Mike a Merry Christmas email next Saturday.
Because frankly, Mike lives here, and in fact, we've been meaning to talk to you about the kitchen,
about the smell,
and the smell. Yeah,
sorry, I'm working on that.